Well, you know, Espen, that I am a bit of an idealist, and that one of the reasons why I like the web so much is because, in theory, it is for everyone.
In theory.
And so the question I have today, is it really for everyone?
Oh, I guess I just answered that before you finished the question.
Yeah.
As usual, there's a simple answer, right? Is it for everyone? In theory, it's yeah. Technically it could be, but I don't think it's implemented in a way that it is truly for everyone. Mm-mm-mm. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. Well, exactly that, of course. So I've been thinking about this a lot recently. So back when I was still working as a web developer, I used to work at a big design agency, and the approach there was make it work for most people.
Yeah.
And they would talk about the 80% or 90%. If it works for 90%, it's good, because then it's more than enough to make a good profit. And if you want to optimize it for the last 10%, that's a lot of work.
Yep.
So that's a very, I think it's called a utilitarian approach mm-hmm. to design, right? You just approach, and if most people are happy, then it's good.
Yep.
And of course, there is something to be said about that. Unless, of course, you're in the 10% and you really need this thing, then... And there's no alternative.
Yeah.
Then, of course, it's not that.
Yeah, good. Then it really sucks.
Yeah. And then there's the other thing that I always thought about. What's this idea of the 80% based on? So if I looked at the personas that the designers would choose, they would always look like designers. Mm. And they would always live somewhere in a neighborhood where they lived themselves. It was always, they were
maybe just had a very diverse group of designers.
Change a little bit. So I'm not really sure if this 80% is really 80%.
No.
In my experience, it's based on nothing, actually. It's just bollocks.
A hunch.
And not even a hunch. I think it's just laziness, and we like it.
Yeah.
That's basically what it yeah. means. But it is from a business perspective, I think somehow it could make sense. Is that your experience as well? Do you know?
Yes, I think so, in a nutshell. First of all, of course, you know, we make personas and stuff. When it's just based on guesswork anyway, it's bound to be, you know, you might go, oh no, this one is a woman, so it's very different to me. But it's essentially based on whomever writes the persona is going to be based on their experiences and or assumptions about what people are like. And then, of course, you could assume, like in a theater, you could assume that we're going to have people in wheelchairs here, so we better have some ramps or, you know, whatever. We can consult someone maybe to help us install the right type of equipment. But yeah, no, this attitude, I'm guilty of the same attitude of, you know... It's gonna work for most of our audience, and to do this other thing is actually gonna add X to the budget, or it's gonna be some other complication. So, is it worth it from a business perspective? And maybe the client assumes no. They assume no. They don't know, but you know, it's just like, yeah, it works for most of us. It works for the designers, the developers, the client's happy. They've sent it to their friends and family. Everyone who's looked at it has given us decent feedback, but of course, we haven't sent it to blind people, or you know, someone on a 2G phone in the Scottish Highlands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay, and then there's the other thing that so this is, let's say, I think the vast majority of professional websites are based on this idea, right? If it works for most people, it's good enough. Let's not talk about the amateur websites, because I think that's really something else. But if we look at professional websites, really well-made professional websites, then I think this is the standard approach. And then you have, of course, the approach based on intent, which is, I think, if you look at web accessibility, what they've been, or we have been, or they've been promoting for the last decades, is that if you just use these guidelines, this long list of guidelines, then your website will be accessible for much more than just 80% of the people.
Yeah.
And I always wonder, as a designer, how do you look at this approach?
Right. So a while ago, I guess pre-responsive, when mm-hmm. fonts were loaded using QFON and other things that I didn't understand, and where there were no variables, and oh my god, the way things were implemented then was is incredible. But
floats. Do you remember floats?
Yeah, I mean, back then I didn't touch code, so for me it was I entered the room of the developers and sat down, and we did design tweaks together, and it was a bit like, it just seemed crazy. We'd make all these changes, copy and paste the whole CSS sheet, and just like FTP it up somewhere and hit refresh, and you know. Back then I remember there was a discussion around M's and pixels, and how, like, if you set the font size to a certain pixel value, you'll screw it up for everybody who wants to zoom in and out. Didn't know enough about it then, and I don't know what it was like in older browsers, but there was, I remember there was distinctly some thing where you could literally screw it up for people. If you were too prescriptive in the code, people wouldn't be able to manipulate the browser to their own needs. But now my impression is that as long as you implement properly, you know, you won't have an issue. People can still zoom in and out, and the browser itself will help in some way. Because there is a challenge, I think. First of all, philosophically, is it possible to make something that works for everybody? Is it actually, you know, by catering for some niche, are you going to exclude another niche? So philosophically, is it even theoretically possible? The other thing is to design something that is impactful, or, you know, emotional, or some sort of, it has an impact. Is it possible to do that and at the same time cater for absolutely everything? An example of this is when I was doing print design, you know, there are guidelines, especially if you work with public bodies, or, you know, agencies that speak to the public. There are guidelines for accessibility, essentially. But they're not as strict as the guidelines we have for the web, and they're not verifiable in the same way. You can't just run it through some sort of algorithm and get a grade. But obviously it includes things like contrast, and, you know, you have to have the text needs to be at a certain size, whatever. But of course, if you're designing a brochure or a prospectus or something like that, if you're going to do the whole thing at 12 points and 1.5 line height, it's going to blow your budget. You're going to have like 1,000 page prospectus, right? You just can't do that. So I think the approach that I've seen is that on small leaflets and stuff, there's accessibility options available. So if this is not readable to you, you can order something in bigger print, you can have it in an audio version if you call a number and stuff like that. So the main thing is designed for the assumptive 80%, but then you provide alternatives for the fringe cases, and to me, that's the compromise in delivering something that actually has its own, I don't know, personality or visual expression or something. You're able to do something in a certain way, but also you are catering for anyone who might struggle with your particular format. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Okay. Some sort of similar approach to web design, because Have you ever created a separate accessible website?
No, I haven't. And I'm speaking to you about all these things, especially with screen readers and stuff. I think, at least for me, but you know, I'm quite novice when it comes to implementation and build. The assumption is that if you do things by the book, well, then people with special requirements will be able to use mm-hmm. their technology, their own technologies, to access your content. But then you're saying, actually, screen readers suck. So, you know, mm-hmm. someone should sit down and design an experience that is better catered for people who use a screen reading technology. So that's where it ends for me. I don't know what's outside of these boundaries, but I do assume, if I follow the guidelines on contrast, if I don't mess around with kind of default browser-y settings, implement font sizes and stuff correctly, I use M's for line height, you know, people can scale and adjust and use their own technology to adjust the content to their needs. That's my assumption.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So in my experience, how I've seen these guidelines, I used to like the guidelines, but when I worked with designers, they used to hate the guidelines, because after the fact, when their design was done, they would get this grade and it would say, well, this is not good, you have to fix this and fix this and fix this. And people don't like fixing bugs, or most people don't like it. And in many cases, it was even some major changes were necessary. So in my experience is that people don't really like these things. But even if they do implement them, it doesn't even mean that the site is accessible. That it or theoretically it is accessible then, but it doesn't mean that in practice it is usable. So this is something that really struck me, that you have these websites that are accessible according to the guidelines. I mean, you can check it and you can test it, and they get tested. But in practice, if you really want to use them, they're just such a horrible experience that they cannot use them. So I once watched a blind guy. I met him for the first time that day, and he showed me how he uses the web. And he showed me that he wanted to send money from one bank account to another bank account, 2,000 euros. It's quite a big amount of money. He wanted to send it from his one bank account to his other bank account with his banking website, which is a huge website in the Netherlands, right? It's not some sort of just a small thing. No, it's very big. He couldn't do it. He couldn't find the button that said transfer money, which when we look at it, it's the biggest button. Yeah. It's right there. There's no way to miss it. He couldn't find it. It wasn't there. So I sent the money. I did it for him, which is ridiculous. Mm. I would never ask someone who enters my house for the first time to transfer 2,000 euros, right? So this site, of course, in theory, it is accessible and it's probably well built, but it's not accessible. And this is the problem that I have with this approach that we have, the accessibility world, is that it's based on intent. So the intentions are very good.
Yeah.
So if we follow the guidelines, then we have an accessible website, but it's not about the outcome. It's very much about our intentions were good, so we're fine. We did whatever we could do.
Yeah.
So, and I think this is actually one of the biggest problems with web accessibility, and one of the reasons why it's not, why people don't use it. It's because it's a set of guidelines and it's not design, right? And you're not allowed to design with it. You have to use them. You have to use these guidelines. So then I think there's a third approach to accessibility, which is result-based, where you know don't just implement the intention, but you actually test it. And if it's not good enough, you fix it.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So and this is something that I'm more and more well, as you may know, what I like a bit more, right? That instead of just and then testing for real people, testing with real people, and just checking what happens there. But this, of course, is pretty expensive, I guess. Or
it's all relative, isn't it? If you're the biggest bank or any of a national bank in any country, you can afford it. Do you know what I mean? It's like, maybe to your bottom line, it doesn't really matter if this guy is not able to transfer the 2,000 euros, because even if he says, well, screw you guys, I'm going to go to another bank, it won't really impact your bottom line too much. But you're providing what's close to a public service. Yes, it's a private enterprise, but come on, it's banking. You know, it's like you should cater for everybody. It's kind of, so then
it's mandatory to have a bank account in the Netherlands.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to live without one.
Oh my God. That's a whole other philosophical debate right there. So then you got to make it accessible. In the same way, you need to have wheelchair accessible entrances to your building. You know, you need to allow people to use the services. Maybe some people would argue, but actually they can just call and we can do exactly the same thing on a phone banking. But in this example, yes, maybe you should have a panel or something and figure out what's the full extent of our users' abilities, and then get users in from all walks of life and actually test your product. That is quite a big process, and I think as a bank you should and could afford to do it. In many, many other instances, it's not even feasible to do it timescales and budget-wise.
But then, let's say, if such a bank did this research and published their research and published their findings, then you could use it, right?
Yeah.
And so this could actually improve the stuff
outside of the bank
we're making. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it doesn't mean that everybody has to do the same research. I mean, if we share our findings. So this also brings me to another thing, which is the, I think you called it fringe cases.
Yeah.
Right? We used to call it edge cases. So the 20% were edge cases. Yep. And the interesting thing is that designers would say, these are the edge cases, we don't have to think about them. While developers... The first thing that developers do is they look for the edge cases and they just test the application to see what happens if instead of 100, I fill in 2 million. Mm. Does it still work? What if, I mean, in the Netherlands, our surnames aren't that long. What if I'm Portuguese?
Yeah.
And married.
Yeah.
And have a three double... surname, right? What happens then? So developers are actually trained to do that, and designers, I think that was just one of the weirdest insights that I ever had, that there's the people who think about the stuff, who create the stuff, have a different, a completely opposite approach than the people who actually build it.
Yeah.
I thought that was weird.
I think it's with design, there's a constant battle of balancing, we can call it accessibility, I suppose, with expression. So when you choose a font, maybe you're making a movie poster. You wanna infuse that poster with the intent of the movie. You know, the feeling of the horror or whatever it might be, and maybe you're choosing a font that's very floral or expressive. Now, of course, even on a movie poster, even if it's just three words and they're big, they need to be legible. They need to be understood. And they need to be understood by people walking past it at a certain distance, you know. And you make these assumptions and you test it in your office and you kind of, this works. No one's told me they can't read this. Now, of course, this very poster, if people stand further away and maybe they have severe... poor eyesight, they won't be able to see it. They won't be able to read it. And at a certain point, designers have to go, well, I'm really sorry. If you want this font or this type of expression, this picture, there's going to be some people at a certain distance where there's a line, and on the other side of that line, it's inaccessible. And it's the same with all the small print on the poster, you know, all this stuff. So every single design decision is taken with this balance in mind. And of course, big display type on a poster is easier to do than, I don't know, technical text on a document with small print, or a Bible or something like that. I mean, a lot of people wouldn't be able to read the Bible, right? Because the writing is so small. So I think we're always fighting these constraints. And this is why designers hate accessibility guidelines, because they have spent 3 months picking this brand color, and now you're telling me I can't use it for my links because some algorithm says the contrast not good enough. Well, everybody in the office can read it. You know, it's this constant challenge. So I'm not really sure how you would begin to say, no, everything you do has to be completely 100% accessible to absolutely everybody. Because
But isn't there maybe a problem that we don't have expressive tools for accessibility? That it's just, if you look at the previous, or I don't remember, a previous episode in which I designed the episode web page to look like what it sounds like if you listen to a website, when you listen to a screen read, everything is just neutral. And if we look at a website, nothing is neutral.
Yeah.
Never. I mean, even a not well-designed website, we still get something out of it. And if it's really well-designed, there's lots of emotion. I mean, especially your designs are just filled with emotion and humor or other expressions, and there's just no way to express ourselves. The most expressive stuff that I did with a screen reader is make it giggle.
Yeah. And that was a struggle.
Yeah, it's impossible to make it international.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I made a screen reader say, I made it say boing, 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 which was really cool, which was the best thing they ever heard.
Yeah, I don't know.
So is it maybe something like that, that we need more expression, that we need to be able to, for instance, emphasize stuff and to really emphasize stuff, or to say things in a slower space, slower speed,
Of course. I mean, in another, maybe it was that episode about the screen readers, we talked about this, how the screen reader experience is not fit for purpose, and it's been, you know, the same for decades, and it's based on old technology and whatnot. I guess in theory, soon we'll have AI that can create human-like voices, and maybe some of these things will become more accessible to designers and coders. So to actually use, I don't know, maybe you could tie it up to semantics, and if you use bold or emphasis or something like that, the voice changes too. Maybe you can have, in the same way you would choose the color, background color of a document, you could maybe choose the background ambience or the background, you know, you can infuse this non-visual experience.
These things actually exist. It does exist. So there's this markup language for voice.
Yeah.
For it's pretty primitive, but it's, I use it in one of my art projects. It's really nice. So you can lower the pitch and higher the pitch. And you can, even within a sentence, you can just make this wave of that it starts slowly and then goes up and then goes down again. You can actually do this stuff, but it's not implemented on the web. You cannot use it on the web. And I think this is a pity, because I guess if we gave these tools to designers, they would probably love it.
I think if the tools were...
Some of them,
yeah,
not all
if
of
they
them.
Were accessible, you'd definitely see some high-profile advert campaigns using these technologies, and it would be a big hoo-ha in social media. But the average designer on the average website, I mean, we can't even... It's hard enough to get people to use just basic accessibility guidelines to dig into these technologies and implement them with intonation and tone of voice on your websites. It's a stretch, I guess. I mean, You would have to really...
But couldn't it just work the other way, that once you start designing for screen readers, that then you get interested in, okay, so how do they actually work, and what's the research that has already been done? And then you come up with these guidelines. Oh, look, we can use these guidelines. So it could work the other way. And right now, it's a document that says no.
This is true.
You did it wrong.
Yeah, that's true.
And then it's a much more positive document where...
All this stuff is possible. Way, yeah. I don't know either. I find the whole thing quite challenging.
My main
thing is that in the physical world, it's been accepted that you go to supply a different experience to different needs. For example, wheelchair accessible entrances, most of them have stairs and a ramp. The stairs are cheaper to implement and quicker to walk up, so they don't remove them. They keep them in place for people who can use them, and then they add the ramp. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's some sort of, implied discrimination, that we take this need that is the minority need and make that the add-on instead of the main thing. You know, maybe all entrances should be... No, it's mainly a big ramp, but you could take these stairs on the side if you want to take a shortcut or whatever. But, you know,
it's always something that surprises me with toilets, that you have these wheelchair toilets which are not allowed to be used by the rest of the world, which I think
maybe all toilets should be like big, spacious and nice and easy to use for everybody. And then you could have like a tiny room with urinals if you want to just nip in for a quick wee.
Right.
But it's the same with Braille, right? You have books with printed letters. In some cases, you can call a number and they could order you a large print book, or maybe you can call a number and have things read out to you. You also have books that are in Braille and they're purely for blind people, completely inaccessible if you haven't learned that language. So my feeling is to me that there has to be like some sort of hybrid approach, where I don't think it's possible to design one experience that works equally well for everybody. It's more like you got one experience here and maybe that caters for 68% of your audience. Then there's another experience for 10% and so on until you've filled every single brackets of audience, so to speak.
Yeah, that, I think that the problem that many accessibility people have there is that the same problem that we used to have with mobile websites that we had up until 10 years ago, that the mobile website was always an afterthought.
Yes.
And it was always a subset of the real website. So the first mobile websites, I remember, you just need the address.
Yeah.
Right, because people are on the move and they only need to know the address.
And that's also a budget thing, isn't it? It's like, oh my God, building the whole website again with this crazy constraint of a tiny screen. Let's just at least just give them the phone number and the address, and that's good enough for now.
So the what accessibility people are afraid of, and I think they're right, is that it will be. Not as well maintained website as the original one.
Yeah.
So the content will always be behind, even if maybe they stop updating it, maybe they don't remember it, right?
Not a separate website per se, but maybe it's more akin to the difference between reading and seeing the content visually and having it read to you from a screen reader. Those are the same thing, but different experiences, right?
True. Yeah, true. You could add a theme, right? We're used to theming. Well,
yeah, you could have a theme.
You could see it as a theme. Yeah, things like that should be possible. Why not?
Yep. But all of those things are...
And then there's the other approach where I thought that was a very interesting approach. If you don't call it edge cases, but stress cases, and you say these are the people that are in highest need or have the most difficulty to use your website. I mean, if you see somebody who has a problem using your product, then you help them, right? If I see somebody who has a problem just crossing the street, I would help them. Or they cannot pick something up high in the store,
you help.
I'll help them and I'll pick it for them, right? So what if you, instead of seeing them as edge cases, you see them as stress cases and say, okay, these are the people that we start with. So instead of designing for them as an afterthought, you start designing for them, and then you see the 80% as an afterthought, with the idea that, well, if these 10% can use it, the rest will probably be able to use it as well.
Yeah. And this feels a bit like progressive enhancement, or the intent or philosophy behind that, where you start with, if it's just content on a page, you know, you have text, it's semantically correct, it's just there, it's readable for absolutely everybody. And then you go, I'm going to add a menu. Okay, well, the menu starts off with just being a list of links, and now it's accessible to everybody. And then maybe you use some CSS or something to display it differently, but the core of it, it's still accessible to everybody. This was also something that we thought of early in Responsive, is that, okay, you're going to have a mobile version. If it's too costly or too difficult to make it feel and look exactly like the desktop version, well, at least just put all the content on the mobile version. And then people could read everything and access everything, but maybe not as look as nice. So maybe the visual side of things, this perfected like visual interface, maybe that's the add-on. And if you add it on progressively, you shouldn't break the sort of previous non-visual version of it.
Yeah, it's also something that, and this is hard to teach. So my students don't, they have a hard time understanding it. So if, when you start designing content, then layout is optional.
Yeah.
Layout is not necessary. Yeah. You don't need to put things in two or three columns. One column works, right? If it works for a phone, it works for a desktop, right? But we, our tools somehow invite us to start visually instead of start with the content, right?
Yeah, our tools and our, I don't know what it is, some sort of cultural heritage, not heritage, cultural conditioning. It's like,
I'm not really sure though, because if you look at the magazines that you used to make, the paper magazines, they were often based on the content of the just like what we do with our website. It's based on what we're talking about. The design is and now we're more of system designers, maybe.
Yeah, in that sense it's a big difference, but with magazines, there's always the argument that a Word document is just as good as a magazine because all the text is there and it's one column. All the pictures and treatments and different fonts and columns, all this stuff, some of it is economical, but a lot of it is stylistic as well, right? So one is we need to fit this into the format of a magazine. And then you have concerns like, we know that if we add these elements, people will engage more with this article, like pull quotes or big headlines or really nice photography, you know. So you put that in there to help the experience and make the magazine cooler. And then you add visual decisions that are purely to give your magazine a flavor. So we use these fonts and these colors because that's our brand. And we write in this way because that's our brand. But I think magazine design, way more than web design, is not inaccessible, but there's certainly, print designers take much bigger liberties with contrast, and there's crazy layouts, and there's like gray on gray, and there's a lot of decisions made that look so cool and it's bloody amazing, but it wouldn't pass accessibility tests online. I don't know what the question was or what I was even answering there, but
we're talking about stress cases, and we were talking about,
I seem to remember that there was a designer at some point who felt like everything should just be designed using Helvetica, because the human race had reached the perfect font. It was, it works, everybody reads it, it's been stress tested, so just use Helvetica everywhere. And in a way, he or she would be correct, right? It would be accessible, you would, you know, it would work, but it would be boring. It would be one-sided. No, nothing would stand out. And this is the what I'm talking about, I mean, this constant conflict with accessibility and expression is if you reduce everything to its most pure accessible form, it would just be single column text, big images, large font size, you know, Arial. You don't need anything but Arial.
It's just very strict, very basic definition of usability. It has to be usable, while the expression is just not there. And I think expression is very important, right? The details that make us smile, right? And smiling is important. It's very hard to smile when you are the only form of input is a screen reader.
Totally. It's hard.
Yeah.
Now, another way of looking at the same conflict or the same challenge is not even going as far as screen readers, but you know, a few years ago we had this real issue with browser compatibility as well. So you had constantly this challenge of, okay, you make something, now is it accessible in this form on all the different browsers? And for the longest time the answer was no. On this browser you get the text and the pictures, on this browser you get the text to pictures and the visual details, because simply we don't have the budget to sit and hack all these flourishes to make it work in the IE6 or whatever. We did at my previous job, we did an annual report for a big bank, and we had some illustrations at sort of the chapter intros or whatever you want to call them, and each sort of section had its own illustration at the top. And I thought, oh, it'd be nice to animate these in some way. So there were some graphs and some whatnot that would fade in, and it wasn't anything critical. There was no critical information there. It was just this, it made the page come alive just slightly. But there was no real budget for this, and it was just me doing it. So I said, look, give us 2 days and I'll go and make some animations. And we did the animations, we came back, and suddenly it turns out some of the things in some of the animations didn't work in Safari. And then it raises for me an interesting philosophical question, because does that mean that you shouldn't have the animation at all? Because it doesn't work somewhere. It's inaccessible to some people. Does that mean it shouldn't be supplied to other people? Or should you change it in a way that's, I guess, more boring or different or not as nice, but it works everybody or everywhere? Or is it okay to say, you know, you have this equipment, so you get this version, you have this other equipment, you get this other version? It's the same, obviously in this case it's not important information, so it doesn't matter as much, but it's the same conflict, isn't it, with accessible stuff and non-accessible stuff. If I have the resources or the intent or the will or the idea to create some GL 3D crazy funky looking thing, should I not create that because I won't be able to recreate it for everybody?
Very good question. And I think it's even a weird question. I mean, I had the same discussion over and over with all the clients when progressive enhancement was new and IE6 or IE7 or IE8 or all IE family was the biggest family by far. And we had all this cool stuff that we could use. And I would say, instead of just sending all these images to all these old browsers, let's just make square corners, send square corners to old browsers and rounded corners to new browsers. Yeah. And so that was just... No way.
Right.
And even later on, right, these things like the simple animations, then it would be, no, then we won't do it for anybody. But the weird thing is that layout, they would accept it. Well, if your device doesn't support layout.
Single column is fine.
Because it's too small.
Oh, yeah.
Single column is fine. But then when it's wider, we need layout. And this was silly because making layout for IE was hard. And making layout for modern browsers is easy, right? And then we had to emulate layout with old-fashioned techniques for old browsers because this is something that's weird. Yeah. But browsers are getting better at this. Should browsers actually, shouldn't it be a thing that browsers should fix instead of us designers and developers fixing it? Because if you look at web accessibility, what has the 20 or 30 years brought us? I think only more inaccessible websites, right?
I don't know. I don't know if
we
that's
have much more inaccessible websites nowadays than we had 30 years
ago.
Yeah,
but I think that's sure. That's an explosion of technologies making the act of producing websites more accessible to people rather than the failings of the accessibility movement.
Yeah,
you know, I have technology at my fingertips that it allows me to make shit websites, so I'm gonna do that.
Yeah, so but then are we targeting the right people? So we are talking to designers and developers. Make your websites accessible. Well, if you look at just any website out there, doesn't matter which one, and you look at the heading level hierarchy, it's just not good. Probably,
yeah.
It's never good. If you look at link text, it's probably not good. So all these basic things, people just don't know it. So aren't we talking to the wrong people, and shouldn't browsers fix this stuff? So if all the links just say read more, then shouldn't the browser add more context to it? Or shouldn't the screen reader add more context to it if you want to have it read out loud?
That would be amazing. I think... In any case, it's really good advice or best practice to not say read more anyway. Even for people who can see visually, it's more informative if it says check out the latest episode instead of read more or view all episodes, you know.
Yeah.
But a great example of this, I think, would be alt text for images. Because... Mm-hmm. Now it's hardly designers or developers that are suddenly responsible for the alt text. It's the publisher, some person who wrote the blog article or a magazine article somewhere. They have to add this alt text in WordPress or whatever CMS.
Mm-hmm,
So and that's something I think AI should be able to write for us. Here's a picture of a dog.
Don't know if you've ever heard. Have you ever heard generated alt text?
No, I haven't.
I think it's the same 80-20% thing. It works
often. Yeah.
But when it doesn't work,
that's back to that question again, though. If you could do it for, you know, quote unquote free, it was built into all browsers, and it worked in 80% of cases. The AI got it right, but you would have a whole bunch of cases where it wasn't right, and your designers and developers and publishers would become lazy because they wouldn't think about it anymore. Now, does that mean you should do it because most of the time it would work? Or should you not do it because it doesn't work all the time?
Well, and in this case, we even assume that publishers take the time to add alternative text, but they don't.
No.
Right? So if you add an AI to read out the images, it's probably better.
Yeah, and maybe it's at least do it as a default, and then you can override it if you see that it's wrong, if you happen to see it. It's the same with just slightly talking about performance. You can't expect publishers to have Photoshop installed and optimize their images. It has to be the technology that does this.
Of course. And it's very easy to have the technology.
Yeah, well, you think so.
Yeah, well, I actually made it myself once. So if I can do it, a real developer should be able
to
do it.
I think it's built into WordPress now. Of course, there's going to be opinions about what's the correct level of optimization and how much do you degrade images and stuff. And similarly, if there was AI that wrote alt text or changed your semantics or added context to your link text, there would be some conversations about bias and opinion and, you know, how to implement it. But of course, I don't think in my lifetime that you'll have visual designers who have the time, resources, interest, and technical ability to recreate the screen reader experience. I do think it needs to come from a technical perspective. You know, it has to be... As a designer...
Yeah, or a sound designer.
Sure. If you're the big bank and you can employ a team of 10 people to make this website, that's great. But if there's two of you, you need the technology to do it. Just like you need WordPress or whatever to optimize your images, you would need the screen reader to optimize the text or to read it out properly or something. But, of course...
I'm not... I always start imagining design tools that you have your headphones on and you're designing this headline with colors, yeah. And then it starts speaking to you what it would sound
that
like.
That would be amazing.
Right? You could simply adjust it. No. The voice should be less pink because it sounds too red now.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, the tools could be so much
if
better.
If it was at that level, I think it would work. You know, if you sit in, I guess at that point, you wouldn't even sit in Figma. Maybe you just sit and you do this stuff in some sort of code-based design tool with a headset. Yeah. Then I think you could grab people. If it was that accessible, it would be fun to play with, and then suddenly you would have these experiences made. Yeah.
And now it's the opposite. So last week I tested, or my students tested their own website that I've been making in the last weeks. They tested it with a screen reader, and just the class was just, it was chaos. They were screaming and yelling.
Revolution.
This is awful. No. They hated it. They couldn't understand it, and they were just, they had headaches afterwards. Yeah. It was just awful experience. And then I discuss with them, so look at your website. It looks good, right? Well, not all of them, of course, but and they were happy with it, and there were some funny details. Yeah. And all was lost. All is lost on these screen readers. Yeah. We need better tooling for that.
For sure.
Yeah. Okay. I thought we would be done in 10 minutes with this one.
Yep. I guess we're able to rant and rant.
Okay, thanks again for a very nice conversation.
Likewise, Vasilis. I'll see you next time.